I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. You can find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio. For music events and more, you can email us at pdxnativeradio@gmail.com. As always, we'll see you next week, Indian Country.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
K-B-O-O Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Now Give It Back, Indigenized Futures and the Land Back Movement, host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, Associate Professor and Department Chair of Native American Studies at Cal Poly Humboldt. Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy is the co-director of the Cal Poly Humboldt Native American Studies Food Sovereignty Lab and Traditional Ecological Knowledges Institute. Her book, We Are Dancing for You, Native Feminisms and the Revitalization of Women's Coming-of-Age Ceremonies, received Best First Book in Native American and Indigenous Studies at the 2019 Native American Indigenous Studies Association Conference. She is also the volunteer executive director of the Native Women's Collective, a nonprofit organization that supports the continued revitalization of Native American arts and culture. She is Hupa, Harut, and Yurok, and is enrolled in the Hupa Valley Tribe.
First, we want to share a report from Yurok Country in the Pacific Northwest. The largest dam removal in U.S. history has entered a critical phase with the lowering of the dammed reservoirs on the Klamath River, with members of the Yurok tribe leading the effort. We use this as an example of why indigenous people must be leading the efforts of conservation, which is the basis of the land back movement discussed in today's show. Amy Cordalis, attorney and Yurok tribe member who has played a critical role in advocating for dam removal, was quoted on Oregon Public Broadcasting. This is historic and life-changing, and it means that the Yurok people have a future. It means the river has a future. The salmon have a future. 173 feet high with a 740-foot crest, Iron Gate is an earth embankment dam with a skinny reservoir behind it. The lowering or drawdown of Iron Gate and two other reservoirs on the Klamath River will make way for the removal of three remaining hydroelectric dams that are part of the Lower Klamath Project in Northern California and Southern Oregon. For decades, these barriers have blocked salmon, steelhead, and Pacific lamprey from accessing habitat above them and contributed to poor water quality below. The Klamath River was once the third largest salmon producer on the West Coast, but in the time since the dams were constructed, the Klamath's Coho and Chinook runs have dwindled to a fraction of their historic abundance. Other dam removals on the Penobscot River in Maine and the Elwha River in Washington State have shown that rivers and the fish that depend upon them can recover quickly. Later this winter, J.C. Boyle, the uppermost of the three dams, will be breached, followed by Copco 1. By June, the Klamath River should be flowing more or less within its historic channel, and the work of dismantling the structures can begin. Here is a brief report from Hoopa Country, from ABC 10 in Northern California, featuring Merv George of the Hoopa tribe.
Every 2 years, just before the salmon run in the fall, ceremony leader Merv George gathers members of the Hoopa tribe to perform what's called the White Deerskin Dance.
We've been doing these ceremonies since the beginning of time.
The ceremony involves a 10-day canoe ride down the Trinity River. And the pinnacle of the ceremony is the boat dance, a highly sacred event that cannot be filmed or photographed, and that includes our cameras.
If you take pictures during the ceremonies or if you're trying to film stuff, the Kahanai probably thinks that you want to know what they look like and they may take you. So that's part of the reason why we don't want people to film these things. So we really appreciate that.
The white deerskin dance is essential to Hoopa culture. And its origin is told through a story which starts with a trickster named Coyote, who wanted very much to steal a woodpecker blanket from the Hoopa's spirits, whom they call the Kahenai.
But then he knew the Kahenai were going to be chasing him, and they were going to want their blanket back. So he needed to outrun them. So he made himself a huge bow up here on Bald Hill, and he shot himself to get away from the Kahenai that was chasing him.
Coyote spent several days hiding from the Kahenai. He moved along the Trinity River from one location to another until one day the Kahenai found him and took back the woodpecker blanket.
Part of his punishment was that he needed to teach us mortals how to be able to gather things for yourself, to be able to make your own woodpecker blanket. And that's part of the reason we got this ceremony handed to us.
Stories like this help keep the Hoopa's culture alive. As it's passed down, it reminds new generations the importance of the water and the land they live on.
We're definitely known for one of the tribes that have been able to keep our culture going since day one.
Mainly due to the remoteness of their territory, the U.S. government never forced the Hoopa off their land. Unlike most Native American tribes, a treaty was signed in 1864, protecting the land that the Hoopa lived on, but it didn't protect the water that ran through it.
Since the dams went in, of course, it made it a lot easier to divert the water that normally should be coming down here to go somewhere else.
The problem is to get water from where it falls to where it will do the most good.
Starting in the early 1930s, a massive water reclamation and relocation effort known as the Central Valley Project began. Today, 18 dams and reservoirs on major rivers, including the Trinity, store water, create electricity, and transport that water to thirsty crops from Redding to Bakersfield.
New resources, new wealth, new markets to make America strong and keep America free.
Broadly speaking, everyone who buys or sells grapes, lettuce, and cotton from the Central Valley benefits from the project. Everyone, except the Hoopa.
We started discovering that, we're suffering some salmon population issues.
Prior to 1999, upwards of 90% of the cold, clean water from the Trinity River was ultimately stopped at the Trinity and Lewiston Dam, then diverted to the Sacramento River. That loss of the cold, clean water caused fish kills, like the one that happened in 2002.
When you're looking at 68,000 adult salmon belly up and just littering the sides of the bank, the only thing that I could think of in my mind was sort of the feeling that a lot of the natives had when they were watching all the buffalo get killed.
Merv George and the Hoopa tribe have spent a great deal of time fighting for water rights in the Trinity, and they've made great progress. Today, 50% of the original water flows are released from the dam, but still, it's often not enough. In fact, the Hoopa must actually request from the federal government to release more water just to safely float the river for the white deerskin dance.
And this year being another drought year, I know how valuable this water is.
The agreement on water flows is not ideal, but the Hoopa were here before the dams, and they hope to be here if the day comes when those dams are gone.
You know, our old people tell us, no matter what, you keep these dances going.
From the waters of the Trinity River in Hoopa, I'm John Bartel.
And now our main interview with Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy from Cal Poly Humboldt.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, thank you for joining in today. It's our privilege to have esteemed visionary and provocative guest, Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, joining us today. Writer, educator, and department chair of Native American Studies at Humboldt State University, Dr. Risling-Baldy is a prominent voice and fierce advocate for the land back movement and the return of stolen lands to the original indigenous peoples. We thank the Tongva ancestors for their enduring presence, legacy, and stewardship of this area. Our show comes to you from Kahuengna, or Place of the Fox in Tovangar, or Worlds, which is a name that encompasses the ancestral territory of the Tongva and all of their relatives. We invite you to support sovereign tribal nations and to engage in actions that honor the continuance of their wisdom, heritage, homelands, and lifeways wherever you live. Land back. The movement to return the stolen lands of Turtle Island to the original indigenous peoples has been accelerating for some time now. Indigenous peoples have lost roughly 99% of the lands they originally inhabited on Turtle Island, according to a 2021 data set published in Science. 42% of tribes in historical records have no recognized land today. Land acknowledgments of Native peoples in their homelands remain the bare minimum of what we can do to redress the genocidal campaigns to erase and eradicate Indigenous peoples throughout history. These alone cannot invoke true systemic change. Radical imagination is required to forge a new way out of the injustices and destruction inherent in settler colonialism. As Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy reminds us, decolonization is land back. The time is ripe for actions over tokenism and superficial gestures. We can usher in a revitalized world where stolen lands are returned, where reconciliation is possible, and sacred reciprocity is once again our way of life. It begins with the Indigenous peoples and their reunification with the lands to which their spirits, stories, and legacy belong. Dr. Risling-Baldy states that we can tell a story about Native peoples that begins and ends with genocide. This has been where many choose to start and stop, but we are not a people born in genocide. We are a people who are born through world renewal. We welcome Dr. Risling-Baldy and her insights about how we can actualize land back beyond a dream into a tangible collective reality. Welcome, Kutcha. It is an honor to have you joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for such a great introduction. I really appreciate that.
Is there a particular way you would like to open the show?
Generally, when I introduce myself, I'll say, hey, young Killet, Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy Aholyet. So I'm Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy. I'm Hoopa Yurikan Karuk, enrolled in the Hoopa Valley Tribe, three of the largest tribes in Northern California. Grew up in the Northern California region, very near my tribal homelands. Very fortunate to grow up near my tribal peoples and doing ceremony and learning about culture and Indigenous science and knowledges. So I'm happy to be able to do this work with people today.
Thank you so much for being on the show. We've been looking forward to this for a long time. Now, I wanted to begin with a quote from you. Our knowledge of place is thousands of years old. Our ability to manage in a way that centers land, life, and futures is what will solve this problem. We are not coming to the table just to be heard. We are coming to the table because we know something has to be done. What is that something? Would you say that giving land back is the most obvious and urgent step that we need to take to accelerate restoration of the world?
In my opinion, I think it's the step that's actually going to help us to make a difference in what needs to happen so that we can start thinking beyond colonialism and capitalism. What I'm always telling people is that Indigenous peoples are the peoples of place who have existed here before colonialism and capitalism, which means we have a memory of it. We know that a world, what a world looks like, what a world functions like, and therefore we also know a world post capitalism and colonialism, and we can story it and talk about it and envision it because we've lived it. And so I think land back is an opportunity to start to see, when we think about a world where everyone can breathe and everyone can drink the water and everyone like can, you know, breathe the air and enjoy themselves, I think we're not asking for much as human beings. And it's us that really are the people that can help to reconfigure that in a way that doesn't just repeat colonialism again, but instead says, there's something else. There's something else that we can do.
I think what you said about that you have a memory of before capitalism and imperialism, materialism is really critical for people to remember that there are, I mean, when I think about even the date of people saying things like 2023, it's very disturbing, actually, when you think of time and that what a distortion that is to even hear like 2023. It's very bizarre. But, you know, you've stated that clearly that decolonization is land back. And you mentioned that people are not really decolonizing until they give lands back. So would you like to say anything to those people who, you know, they might use these terms like, I'm decolonizing my mind, I'm decolonizing my diet or these institutions? And what do you have to say to people who kind of use that word?
I mean, I think that we have some really good scholars that have done work on this, especially Eve Tuck and Kay Wayne Yang, who wrote a really great article called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor. And really talking about, when we're talking about decolonization, we're not talking about decolonizing our bookshelves or our minds. We're talking about the actions that need to happen so that we can really deconstruct what it is that is building this system that is sort of keeping us all in this space where we don't feel like good about the planet and the direction that things are going in. So it's very obvious, I think, to us that it's not the answer that we should just be living in a world where we can't actually like drink the water or go swimming sometimes, or that it's not a space that we're supposed to be living in this way that we exist right now. I always tell people I talk to, like, it's very clear to me when you start talking to people that they all go like, I don't think the world is supposed to function in a way where I don't have a house or a place to live. I always say, settler colonialism won't even give you a house. It won't even give you the food you need to eat. Right. It won't even make sure that you can like live a day without being stressed out about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And we know that that's not the world that we want to create together. So decolonization has to be a way that we're putting tangible effort into like what that world is going to look like. And that comes from true dismantling of this system. And I think that starts with land back, because the initial sort of theft of land was what was at the heart of how they were going to remake this world through imperialism and capitalism and colonialism. And so the land return helps a reconnection that rebuilds for everyone. We were always thinking about land as this really important relationship that we were entering into. Right. And when colonialism, you know, invades and comes in, it doesn't build that relationship. And so that stoppage, that breaking, that's the thing we've been trying to repair. And I think when you repair that for everyone. You don't just do it for a singular group of people. It, to me, is the answer for how are we going to push back against climate change? Colonialism caused climate change. You're not going to solve climate change with colonialism. So we have to do something that actually reconfigures the world in a way that says you're supposed to be here in a good way. And I think Indigenous peoples have been living that since the beginning of time.
Exactly. Completely agree with you. You know, I wonder if you could please share the computer analogy. Maybe you've told it a million times, but I think it's just so clear and succinct, and it really explains what needs to happen and why. because people have their excuses around not being able to give land back in their minds. But I think the computer analogy is very good. If you could please share that.
So yeah, we're always talking about this idea that all land is stolen indigenous land. And you look at history and you go, well, it doesn't feel stolen to me. But I always say to people, it's all stolen. So let's say you had a computer. Everybody probably has a computer at home. And one day, somebody in your life, and I always use the example of if you're living with someone, like your roommate's significant other shows up and steals your computer from you, and then periodically shows up and uses it in front of you. And what do you do? And I ask people, what do you do? And they say, well, I would ask him to give it back to me. I'd say, give it back. You stole my computer. And I said, well, what if he looks at you and he goes, you know, you weren't really using it. When I discovered it, it wasn't being used. It was just sitting there. It didn't feel like anybody owned it. So I just took it. And what, you just go, oh, sorry, I didn't make it clear it was mine in some way. No, you're going to say, please give it back to me. Mm-hmm. And then he starts to sort of make excuses. So he'll be like, well, you know, okay, selfish. You really want this thing back that I stole from you. How about instead of giving it back to you, I put a sticker on it and it says that it used to belong to you, but now it belongs to me. And wouldn't that be a good thing? Because I'm acknowledging that it used to belong to you. And you're going to be like, cool, thanks so much. I don't need my computer back. I was like, no, you're going to be like, hey, can I just have it back? You're sitting here with it and I'm here and I would like it back. I was like, now he comes to you and he says, you know, instead of you having to just get it back, why don't we make an agreement and co-manage this computer? And then sometimes I can use it and sometimes you can use it. And we'll have a 50-50 sort of say in what happens to this computer. Everything mm-hmm. except for the obvious thing, which is you should return it. You should return it to who it was stolen from. It is very clear in most cases. I can do research for people. I can show them where land was stolen. It was outright stolen, and it was stolen against the laws of the United States itself. Mm-hmm. So it's the U.S. government breaking its own laws to steal mm-hmm. land from indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And knowing that, what does that mean for us as people today? That then what you are essentially doing is trying to sort of get out of returning this stolen item that you know is stolen. And there's no real kind of justification for it. The more you keep adding to it, I was like, what if every time they tell you, every time they stand up, they're going to tell everybody, hey, this computer used to belong to this person. Is that good enough, right? We can keep adding in all the sort of myriad of ways people try to approach this. But the real response is to return it and then see what happens, what builds from that, repairing of this relationship.
Mm-hmm. We will take a break, listeners, and come right back to speak more about some examples of land back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you are enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and listen to extended episodes. You can also get connected with us on social media. Today, you're listening to Now Give It Back, Indigenized Futures and the Land Back Movement, with host Carrie Kim and guest Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, an associate professor and department chair of Native American Studies at Cal Poly Humboldt.
Well, you know, one of the things that I really appreciated in one of your seminal talks about giving land back is mentioning the importance of radical imagination. And you spoke about the need to story into being the giving of land back and this life beyond materialism and capitalism. Could you explain why that is so critically important to this next step of actually giving it back?
I heard this great lecture one time by a woman where she talks about how people have an easier time imagining what they're going to do in a zombie apocalypse. We all have a plan, right? We've all sat down and thought, where am I going to go? What am I going to do in a zombie apocalypse? Then if you ask people, what are you going to do after the end of capitalism? Or what does the end of capitalism look like? They start to get very uncomfortable. They're like, what are you talking about, the end of capitalism? Because we've been taught to function as if settler colonialism is permanent. It's permanency. It exists for all time. They have to make it logical in that way. Otherwise, what we start to discover is how fragile it is.
Right.
I always tell people if settler colonialism, if capitalism, if all those things weren't fragile, then they wouldn't ban books. Right. They wouldn't be like, you can't read this thing, because they know that it actually is kind of held together by duct tape and string. It's really not that strong. And it's there's a way for us to break it down. And what's really beautiful about Land Back in particular is I think that that story had to come into being because Indigenous peoples were willing to say out loud, what if we could just have it back? And one day I will get it back. And one day I will be there again. And the amazing thing about Indigenous peoples is we were living through, you know, an attempted genocide of us. We were seeing what the end of the world actually looked like. We were the people, we're the survivors of an apocalypse. We're the survivors of those that we're the ones who made it through the end of the world. And even during that time, what I know about the work that I've done is people were always talking about the future. They were always saying like 150 years from now, they're going to need these things so that they can heal the earth. 150 years from now, they're going to need to remember this language, these stories, these songs, and they carried them forward even through genocide. They were like, I'm still going to make this thing live. They were telling a story about us. We're the people who exist now 150 years later. We're the people they told stories about because they said, these people will be here someday. We say in an Indigenous context, like nothing can become until you story it into being. You have to like start talking about it and then it can grow from there. That's how you open your imagination. So I think every story I know of Land Back, every example I can give you where it actually like happened and it has been such an important, powerful moment began with someone saying, someday we're going to get that piece of land back. And this is what it will be like. And this is why we do the work that we do. And even if it takes 150 years, we're going to do that work and to tell that story over and over again. And it usually happens much faster than that. But even if it doesn't, we're still always telling new stories. We were telling stories about dam removal 150 years ago. We were telling stories about the return of our sacred island, this region that I live in. We were telling stories about that from the very beginning. The other day, I was doing an interview with a reporter and they were trying to like, they said they were asking people when they thought the Land Back movement began. And they were saying nobody has like a real date. So they were like, in your opinion, when did the Land Back movement actually begin? And I said, 1493. I think that's when we started talking about what's the world going to look like and what are we going to survive and move toward?
I'm wondering if you could also say a little bit about the story from your own people of the dark cloud and pushing it out, because I think that also is a very relevant story.
Yeah, we do. We have a story about a time when the world went very dark. We talk about like how the cloud came over our valley, it rested over it, and everybody started to get sick and they couldn't see beyond the cloud. It was too dark and there were bad things happening and it was violence and it was really hard on everybody. And the point being that they couldn't see a way out of it. They were just sort of like, this is the way it is, until our first people came and they said, what you need to do is you need to do the work to push the cloud away. And that comes from our ceremonies, our songs. It comes from the work we do with the land. It comes from our relationship. It comes from our knowledge. And they were like, practice this, do this, be here in a good way, and you can push the cloud away. And so we did that. And we watched as the cloud dissipated because we were doing the work we were supposed to do to keep the planet safe. And that to me was teaching us theoretically teaching us about decolonization. It was telling us when these things were happening, it was telling us like, these are the tools that you need to get through the things that you're going to face. And what my elders have always told me is we have the tools we need to build the next world already. We just need to make sure that we believe it and we need to keep doing it even when they try to stop us, even when they try to tell us that it's not worth it.
What do you have to say to settler colonialists, people who are here now on these lands, and how do they push away the dark cloud? Because they're also in it. And they also have suffered through intergenerational traumas of their own, you know, of the peoples who came here. So many in that beginning colonization of this continent were escaping religious, political, economic oppression, slavery, you know, of their own and traumas of their own. And I'm wondering what you feel is their way, because they have even a deeper break in a sense, because many of them can't even go back a generation or two generations, three generations. It's been ruptured for so long, for so many.
I think it really comes from being a good guest in the lands in which you currently occupy and live. That to me is like rebuilding a good relationship with the Indigenous peoples. When people first came here, when you're talking about the very first people sort of coming into this space, Indigenous peoples didn't say like, you know, live here our way or get out. They were like, how do we live here as relatives? You're relatives to us now. We have to share this space. There's enough for everybody, but we need to do that in a good way. The treaties talk about brotherhood, sisterhood, and relationship. So what we're saying is we need to start from that space. What does it mean to build a real relationship with Indigenous peoples in a way that uplifts them because they've been so like oppressed by the settler colonial system, but also demonstrates that there's a certain amount of humbleness to what it means to live in the territory of other Indigenous spaces. I think we do the same thing when we go places, and it's not an impossibility, it's how it started. Right. And I think it's sort of the way that we had always negotiated with peoples in our lands.
Mm-hmm. So Kutcha, if you could please share some examples that have inspired you around land back.
I mean, I think the clearest example is in my own region and territory where I grew up. So I grew up in a place that called Gut Dini, currently called Arcata, California, but Gut Dini means among the redwoods in Wiat, and amongst the sort of territory of the Wiat peoples today includes three tribes, the Bear River Rancheria and the Blue Lake Rancheria and the Wiat tribe. And I was fortunate enough as a young person, my mother was very invested in sort of tribal peoples and areas, and she would teach me a lot about the things that were going on in our region, but she also taught me a lot about the history, and she sort of really storied the landscape for me wherever I was. And when we would drive sort of over the bridge, she would always say, that's Tulawat, that's an island, that's a sacred space for Wiat people. And in the 1800s, the settlers came in the middle of the night and they committed a massacre against them while they were in ceremony. And they mostly killed women and children and babies and elders, because the men were someplace else during ceremony and they would come back to the island. And she would tell me this as we were sort of driving around, and she would say, like, it's a sacred place. It's the center of the world. It's the place of world renewal for the Wiat peoples. And they don't live there currently because after that massacre, many of them had to leave because they were, you know, terrified about what was going to happen. And many of them were killed like that night. And then she would say, that doesn't mean it still isn't a sacred place and a place that we know here in this place. And I remember growing up and listening to the Wiat people, and Cheryl Seidner, who was one of their spiritual leaders, she would go to spaces and she would be like, you know, we're going to get that island back. She just sort of would start talking about, like, one day when we get the island back. There was a point where it came up for, like, a very small portion of it came up for sale. She was like, we have to buy it. We have to buy that. But they don't have very much money. You're talking about a tribe that was removed from different territories, at one point was unrecognized and then had to get re-recognized after suing the government. Like, they had been through so much, but she was unwilling to say that it was impossible, right? So Everybody told her, how are you going to get enough money to buy this? And she started doing bake sales. And she made homemade t-shirts. And she was just like, I don't care what I have to do. And I don't care how long it takes. Like, we are going to get this place back. And she started to go, and I mean, all these people from the community showed up and they were just like, let's talk about it. And they started to do presentations with the city. And they were saying, what if you gave it back? And at first, the response was like, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean just give it back? And it was a lot of discussions. It was a lot of storying. It was a lot of moments. Even though they weren't the owners of the island, they would show up and do candlelight vigils. They would show up and they would sing at the space. They would sort of make sure that the land remembered them, and that they knew they were acknowledging the land itself and saying, this is how important you are to us, and we will be back someday. And 25, 30 years that it took from the moment that the Wiat buys their first piece of land all the way to the return of this sacred island from the city of Eureka to the Wiat tribe, which happened just like 2 years ago.
Right.
What I tell people is, like, I was there, and I had grown up my whole life listening to, like, these stories about what had happened there. And what I thought was so important was this demonstration that for a long time people called Tulawat Indian Island. And the reason why is that this massacre had occurred and they had killed hundreds of native people there. And so they started calling it Indian Island after that. And we would always say to ourselves, like, we don't want to call it that. That's not its name. Its name is Tulawat, right? But what I loved about this story was to watch this reconnection happen, because instead of this story just being about this place as, like, the site of a massacre, of, like, the attempted genocide of an entire tribe, it became about this tribe reconnecting and coming back and saying, we're going to set the world back into balance. That's right. What we're going to do. And all that they had been through. And then watching that be returned, watching the city of Eureka hand it over, watching mm-hmm. that moment, it was, people ask me sometimes, like, what does land back even look like? And I say, I was there uh-huh. when they give the island back. It was the happiest room I've ever been in. Everybody mm-hmm. was smiling and laughing and like hugging. They were so excited about what mm-hmm. it meant. And this is like anybody, not just right. like the tribe, but like every mm-hmm. single community member. Uh-huh. There were hundreds of people there to watch this happen. And it was so beautiful. And it was like so much joy. And I thought, that's what decolonization actually is. People kind of mm-hmm. get scared when you start talking about decolonization and land back. They're like, I'm scared of that. What is it? I said, it actually is so much joy. It's more joy yeah. than I think I've ever experienced in a community.
I wanted to talk a little bit about land acknowledgements because, you know, maybe a lot of them don't go far enough. And, you know, we know that they've become more popularized, especially at universities, even like the Academy Awards a couple of years ago to give acknowledgement to the Tongva people. So what does that mean? You know, are land acknowledgements inherently problematic? Are they an empty gesture or an escape hatch to actually taking action?
They can be. I mean, let's be honest, right? Like, they can be. But at the same time, they come from a very indigenous place. I don't want people to forget that. We acknowledge the land whenever we go anywhere. One of our mm-hmm. first things is we introduce ourselves to the land. We will often leave some kind of gift, usually tobacco or some other kind of like root or things that we use for prayer. We'll tell the land what we're doing there. So we'll be like, we're here because we're doing these things. This is a way for us to build a relationship so that we feel a sense of like responsibility to any place that we go. So it's not like we're disconnected. So it comes from that place, which is like, you should come into a space and really like introduce yourself, not just to the people of that place, but to the land itself and acknowledge that you have a certain amount of responsibility to it, to be able to walk softly, to think about like the impact that you're having, to not sort of like come in and just do whatever you want. That's the indigenous praxis of land acknowledgement. My colleague, Dr. Kayla Begay, talks about how in our language, in the Hoopa language, when we say I'm lost, it doesn't actually mean I'm lost. It means the land doesn't know me. That's what we say. The land doesn't know you. That's why you feel lost in that moment, right? So how do you get the land to know you? They then sort of, land acknowledgements kind of move from there, like this very indigenous place, to settler colonial kind of like excuse for occupying stolen indigenous lands. I think that a number of people have talked about how a lot of institutions that adopt them kind of think like, I've done this land acknowledgement and that's it. I've done enough. I always say it's actually probably the absolute least that you could do in any situation. And what my thing is if you're going to do a land acknowledgement, do something with it. Like, make it a course of action. Say that it dedicates you or your institution or your organization to actually doing something that Indigenous peoples need in order to be able to uphold their sovereignty, their self-determination, and return land. People, I always say, because Indigenous peoples don't need you to tell them that you're on their land.
They are like, here. They don't know.
So who's it for? Like, really, I mean, right. We know where you are. And we know what you're doing there. Like, if you're not going to actually like say what's it for, then don't do it. But otherwise, take the time to be like, if we're doing this, what does it actually mean for us? People mm-hmm. sometimes will call me and be like, can you come to this conference and like do a land acknowledgement? And then I'll always say, why don't you do a land acknowledgement? You need to know whose land you're on. You need mm-hmm. to make a relationship with it. You need to be the person that says why you're saying it. You need to make a course of action. And I think it just gives you an opportunity to really reflect on like, what is it for and what am I doing it for? What does it mean? And also, like, what can I do to support and contribute to the work that Indigenous peoples have already done to mm-hmm. make sure that people are fully engaged with, like, a future that where decolonization is on the table and that discussion is at the heart of some of the things that we've been doing for a very, very long time?
You know, I wanted to go from there to ask about this word steward, because that also gets thrown around a lot.
I mean, I do think that there are people who own or have inherited or have land that they live on, that they feel a deep personal relationship to. And really, I mean, understanding like intergenerational connections to that. So when we as Indigenous people start talking about our deep connections to land, I want people to kind of pull from a place of understanding that like, we know what that feels like. In general, people know what that feels like, to feel like an intergenerational deep connection to the space that you live. And there's always been this story kind of that was created around settler colonialism that somehow, and this is actually, this very much is based in sort of like a white supremacist notion that indigenous peoples were not doing anything with the land, that it was sort of free and open for the taking, that there was a bunch of wilderness, that there was just like, it wasn't being used well. And that so when people came in and they discover it or they take it, that actually what they're doing is preserving or protecting it. John Muir is like a really great example of this, where he's sort of saying, who's going to actually take, like, make sure that this land is cared for, right? And it's this white supremacist notion that only he can do that as like a white male conservation sort of like scholar, like person, right, individual. And I think what happens is that people sort of buy into this notion that somehow they're like protecting the land by owning it. They're not acknowledging a couple of really key things. Indigenous peoples were, I think, more than stewards of the land. They were like understanding the interrelationship between human beings, the environment, and the more than human relatives. And they felt a responsibility for making sure that system was cared for in a way where everybody was considered, there was like an egalitarian consideration of what it meant to live here, where human beings are not the most important sort of thing in this situation. Right. And I think that then you see this massive stealing of land, massive land grabs to build a lot of wealth. And that wealth becomes sort of like how people get uplifted. And then they start to say, I'm the one protecting this land from development, right? And they also feel a great sort of deep relationship to that.
Kutcher, we're going to take a break again right here, and then we're going to talk a bit more about land back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you are enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and listen to extended episodes. You can also get connected with us on social media. Today, you're listening to Now Give It Back, Indigenized Futures and the Land Back Movement, with host Kerry Kim and guest Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, an associate professor and department chair of Native American Studies at Cal Poly Humboldt.
So Kutcha, as we were talking about some of the horrific things that happened, I wondered if you could speak a bit more about the gold rush in California, because a lot of people are really unaware that California was born on the back of genocide and just an incredible slaughter of Native peoples. And it is important to know these things.
Yeah, I mean, especially with California, I think it's important to understand that sort of between 1769, which is when the first California mission was built, and around like 1863, you're talking about an out-and-out genocide, like attempted genocide of California Native peoples. Really, they can figure it at around 90% of the population was killed during this period of time or died during this period of time. So a 90% reduction in a population is very noticeable and tragic. And you're also talking about situations where people are being held in captivity. They are being massacred. They are being hunted. And this happens throughout. This happens through the mission system, through the Mexican ranchero system. But the gold rush is really a particular moment for a massive influx of people into this, what becomes the state of California. I think when we learn about it in California, we kind of hear about it as like a great time of prosperity. It really is a foundational moment for the state of California. It's what builds the wealth that becomes the state of California. What they quickly figure out with the gold rush, though, is that while you're talking about thousands upon thousands of people rushing into this area, is that most people don't really make money off of finding gold. Gold is like difficult to find. You're often talking about larger corporations and more wealthy people can find more gold, but you have all kinds of people rushing in. The people who generally make the money are the people that are selling the supplies or providing some kind of service. And that generally was like hotels or brothels or things like that. So the state of California comes into being sort of like saying, this is a massive place that you can make your fortune. Bunch of people move in. They're not here. They're not trying to set up a colony or a system. They're just here for gold. They'll do whatever it takes to get gold. They start to blow up mountains. They push things into the rivers. They set whole like villages of people on fire and they just knock it over. They pour mercury into the water in certain places because mercury, that gold will actually float above the mercury, and so they can sort of scoop little gold flakes out of streams. You now find that there are streams in California that are still extremely polluted by mercury, and you're unable to sort of like fish in them or do things because of what happened in the gold rush. They dam up rivers without consideration. They do clear cutting. They over harvest all kinds of animals, and the fish especially. In some areas, they make certain fish species go extinct. So this is like what Jack Norton, who wrote a really great book about the genocide in Northwest California, says. He calls them a marauding horde. They just are just coming through and destroying. And in the meantime, the California Native peoples are in the way of that. They are the peoples who have been living here for time immemorial, and they are considered in the way. And by the time they get to California, you start to see them writing letters to each other about, why can't we just push them into the ocean? Why can't we just kill them all? And the policy of the state of California is one of genocide. And it's very clear in the records that it is one of genocide. So they pass several laws that really are just trying to justify and legalize the genocide of California Native peoples. One of the first laws that the state of California passes is the California Volunteer Militia, which offers to pay people to hunt California Indian people. They pay for their scalps and heads. And you could kill them legally and bring the scalps and heads into the courthouse and get paid for them. There are records you can look at of people who have done that. You can see where some of their familial wealth is built off of the massacring of Native peoples and selling their body parts. And so you see that as like a policy of the state of California at the time. Then you also see that they pass a law called the Act for the Government and Protection of Indians. So while California, what we learn a lot about in our California history books is California enters the Union as a no slave state. Like,
right, no slave state, right.
Progressive, right? That we come in and we say no slavery. But at the time, we did pass the Act for the Government and Protection of Indians. Now, this would allow you to take what they called vagrant California Indians. And that's any California Indian who was standing around or did not have a job or own property. And those are things that we were not allowed to do. We were not allowed to own property or have a job. And so that made us vagrant. So they would arrest us and they would put us into jail. And then when we'd go before the Justice of the Peace, we would have to pay a fine. But of course, we had no money. So the Justice of the Peace would say, does anybody want to pay this California Indian's fine? And then they have to become your quote unquote apprentice and work for you. And so they were basically selling California Indians into slavery. And many people participated in this. What I tell people is like, they would just massively like bring people in and they would turn them into these apprentices. But what you find when you look at the records is that most of the people being taken into apprenticeship during when this law was passed in the 1850s were children. And so actually children were the most kidnapped and taken in because they wanted to turn them into apprentices, mostly because they would get longer periods of time with children that would be under apprenticeship, but also children were the most desired. And so they also passed a law that said if you found an Indian child with no parents, you could take them before the Justice of the Peace and you could turn them into apprentices. The easiest way to do that is to kill Indian parents. And people were very open with that. They would actually come before the Justice of the Peace, or they would say, like, people would ask them, where'd you get all these Indian kids? And they would say, oh, they have no parents, so I'm going to make them into apprentices. And they would say, how do you know they have no parents? And they would be like, well, we just killed all their parents. Nobody would get arrested for that. Nobody would sort of like be put into jail for that. It was a system that existed. And then on top of that, what you found is that they actually, through the records, demonstrate that of the children, so it was mostly children ages 7 to 12 that were taken into apprenticeship. But then of that, what you find is that most of those were girls. And so what we always talk about is like, we have to call this what it really was. It was a sex slave industry. They were trading in young Native American girls ages 7 to 12. That's who got them the most money. And that's who they sold most, because they would be sold for the most money. So on top of what they're doing with the genocide, they're then creating this system. So what would happen generally is they would come into an area, they would do massacres where they were trying to like gather up as many people as they could. They would usually kill the men and elders because they were considered not useful to the labor system, and the men as a threat to sort of like the labor system. And they would kill the babies because nobody wanted to take care of them. So you're talking about they would come in and kill this group of people, and then they would take the women and children and they would take them to sell them into slavery. And they create a very large economic development industry off of this. And then what happens is that what you notice in the records is while the girls would usually end up in slavery, the women would disappear from the records. And a lot of the times people will ask me, like, what happened to the women? They were mostly sold under the table, like without the law and not needed to be registered, which meant usually into brothels. And so you're also still talking about building a large trafficking and sex slave industry. It was also an incredibly violent time. You're talking about not just a complete destruction of like people and land, but just violence in general. A lot of people they could be shot on sight for being off reservation. They could be kidnapped just because they were walking in the wrong place. You have people that are doing massacres against Native people pretty like as sort of like events that they were planning together. You have people who became famous Indian hunters, and they would travel around and they would do talks, and people would bring them to fancy dinners. They would meet with like heads of state and political leaders because they were considered very famous for killing all of these Indian people. And so you watch as they become like really elevated in the culture and society. And then on top of that, they are just massively stealing land from Native people. So while they make treaties with the California Indian tribes in the 1850s, they don't ratify those treaties at the congressional level. Those treaties go under an injunction of secrecy, because they don't want the California Indian tribes to know that they haven't been ratified. This means that the tribes start to move into the territories that they have been guaranteed. And then they come back and say, well, you don't actually have a treaty. And now you've moved out of your area. So you abandoned your land. Now you can't go back because we didn't tell you about these agreements. You see like a massive amount of what they call landless and homeless Indians that develop out of that. But really what it does is the treaties would have guaranteed about 7 million acres of land to tribes. And they were signed and agreed to by the U.S. federal government. It would have been a significant percentage of the state, at least 7% of the state would have been guaranteed to Native peoples. When the treaties were put under an injunction of secrecy, all of that went away. So that was a massive land theft. And then post that, they start doing land theft around, like they create national and state parks, a land theft. In the 1850s, Abraham Lincoln decides that he's going to give a bunch of land to universities, like land grant universities. That's a massive indigenous land theft, especially throughout California. And a lot of that comes from them figuring out that that's where the wealth is, and also that they need to get control of the land areas and put borders around them and make sure they have like deeds and documents. Because Californian people really have the claim to it, especially after they refused to ratify the treaties that we signed.
Wow. The history is so long and deep. You know, you've said that Indigenous peoples are more than the traumas that they have endured, and also that they've always known that there would be a time when they would have the resurgence and they would return. As you said, Indigenous people are born through world renewal. What does that look like to you?
Well, I think I can come back to Tulawat one more time. So the Wiat, they've taught me so much. Like when I tell people, when we start to get into conversations about how we're going to build something, a program, a project, something so that we could help people to build land back initiatives, right? And people start going, that feels like a lot to take on. And it feels like it's not going to happen, or like it would be too much, or like, how are you going to actually? And I think about the Wiat and I think about the work that they did, and the story that you can tell about Tulawat, you can tell this story of Tulawat about a group of people who were peacefully doing a world renewal ceremony on their island to try to rebalance the world, to make sure that the world was safe for everyone. And in the middle of the night, a group of men showed up with hatchets and knives to kill them each one by one. And I tell people, I want you to know that like we were human beings living through that. So we probably begged for our lives. We probably cried and begged them to stop. We probably tried to protect the babies from being hurt. We probably ran and screamed, like to think of us as human beings navigating that. What does that mean in that moment? And then in the morning, there were two survivors of the Tulawat massacre. And in the morning, there was a baby who had survived. They tell this story about it crawling through the mud, trying to find its mother. And then there was a woman. And she was stuck. The island gets very muddy because of the way that the tides work. And she was stuck in the mud. And what they say is that when they found her, she was singing. And Cheryl Seidner, who's the cultural leader, she talks about how she thinks it was probably a mourning song, M-O-U-R, mourning, that she was probably singing for her people. Mm. And I tell people, like, imagine yourself in that moment. I was like, I don't know if I would have been strong enough to survive that. I also don't know if I would have been strong enough to be standing there amongst, like, the just the horrificness of what just happened. And then to think to myself, I have to sing my people to the next world. I have to help them go to the next part. I have to sing for them. And then to stand there singing till the sun came up, and to make sure that they, like, had a way to go home, right? That's the strength that we carry with us. She was thinking about the rest of us. She was like, we have to heal from this. We have to push ourselves forward. We have to make sure that we don't stop. She didn't give up. She sang a song for her people. And she was like, this is what we're going to do. So she, much as we talked about, she was pushing the dark cloud away with all the things that we had. And that's, to me, what we do. That's who we've always been. And I want people to know that about us. I want them to know that, like, as we were going through some of the most horrific things I think that we could have gone through, we were telling a story about a future where we were all going to be together again, singing, or we were all going to do a dance again, or we were all going to make sure that the world was put back into balance, and we didn't stop. And we just, no matter what we had to do, we tried to make it happen. But we didn't just do that for ourselves. When we talk about rebalancing the world, that's like, we knew that had to happen for everyone. We knew that had to happen for everybody to be here in a good way. And that the world could be made possible through that. So I really value that I was like raised in this way to say there was the horrificness of genocide, but we are not a people that are just born in genocide. We are a people that were born with a resilience, a strength, and a power to move us forward, that we've been given that since the beginning of time, and that we have to rely on that. And then we have to remind ourselves that our everyday existence is because nobody, like, everybody knew that we would be here, that we're the future that they imagined. So what are the future we are going to imagine? 150 years from now, the stories that we told about who they're going to be, they'll be talking about us. They'll be saying, well, this is what they were saying that we should do. And here we are doing that work, right? Here we are, like, being imagined into being. And I love that I got to be there when Tulawa was returned. And I love that they sang a coming home song for the land in that island. And I think about how that song started, you know, 150, 250 years ago. It started in that moment with this woman who was like, I'm going to sing my people home.
Kosha, could you please tell us how listeners can stay in contact with you and also the Land Back movement? What are some ways that they can connect with you?
I'm on Twitter it's at Kosha Baldy. I do a lot of posting about things that are coming up and sort of my random thoughts. I get random 3 a.m. thoughts at some points. That's a great place to kind of see a little bit more about me and get to know me. I have my book, which is We Are Dancing for You, and it's about revitalization, cultural revitalization. And it tells, I think, a really particular story about genocide through the perspective of what happened, especially to women during genocide in California. So I'd encourage people to, if you want to pick it up and read a little bit more about it. And then, you know, you can always sort of, like, Google and email me through, like, contact forms and things. I'm always interested in having ongoing conversations with people. I do say my favorite thing is to be the person that gets invited to an organization, a museum, someplace that might have thought, I don't know if I want to have this conversation, and just come in and be like, let me lay it all out for you. You might get really upset. Then maybe 5 years from now, you'll start to ask different questions. I'm here then too. So I'm willing to do that also, if you just want to start the conversation.
Kosha, thank you so much for all that you bring to the world and all that you're doing for Land Back. I know it is also your heritage and your, you know, reason for being on this planet, but I just really thank you for being that voice out there, because you have really moved so many people in this direction that we know is ultimately going to happen. It's just a question of when. You know, it's not a question of if, it is a question of when. So thank you so much again for joining us. And, you know, also that you have those videos on YouTube also around Land Back, which are really important seminal videos that people can watch and just start dreaming in. And as you say, using their radical imagination to see something beyond what currently is the status quo here on this continent. Because there's much more beyond that, and there's much more before that. So thank you. Thank you again for joining us.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore other shows, visit our website at ecojusticeradio.org and also subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Now Give It Back, Indigenized Futures and the Land Back Movement. Thank you to our guest, Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Adventures in Waste. And if you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer Jack Eye, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned. KBOO.